This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of June the 8th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated. We're going to go ahead now and take a look at some of the things that have happened this past week in the area of federal taxes. And we're going to begin here with a private letter ruling, Private Letter Ruling 2015-23025. And this ruling is one of many that we see quite often where taxpayers have made a rollover or attempted to take funds from an IRA account, wanted to roll them into another IRA account, and for whatever reason, before the end of the 60 days, they don't manage to get that done. And what happened in this particular case was the taxpayer took the funds from the IRA. He intended to move to another IRA because he wanted to try to improve his return. However, following the time he took the money out, deposited into another account where he intended to then make a check out of that account and deposit it with a regular IRA. During that time, however, he suffered an injury on the job. And while the private letterling doesn't tell us for sure, it appears that that injury at least kept him for sure out of work beyond the end of the 60-day period. Therefore, we might even assume that maybe he was unable to complete the rollover during that time frame because of his medical disability, because he had another challenge at that point. He was also caring for his disabled spouse. On paper, this looks like a perfect we're going to get relief ruling because Revenue Procedure 2003-16, which is what the IRS has used to tell you what types of relief they're willing to grant in this area, pretty clearly states that issues that arise due to medical problems, and the rulings have been pretty clear, say either the taxpayer's medical problem or a medical problem of somebody who the taxpayer needs to care for, like a spouse, almost always get relief if you can show that that prevented you from making the rollover. But in this particular case, the taxpayer would be denied relief. Now that gets more interesting. What went wrong in this case? Well, in this case, the taxpayer, for whatever reason, not explained in the ruling, the taxpayer took money that was sitting in that account that he had planned to roll over into the other IRA, and he used that to pay personal bills. Now, it may very well have been that because he was disabled and basically couldn't work, not disabled, but he had a job injury and wasn't working, that there may have been various expenses that he needed to pay. May or may not have been able to come up with the money otherwise. We don't know why he did it. But in any event, he didn't return the money to the checking account until well after the end of the 60-day period and well after the end of his disability, the end of his leave time. So it took about 6 months later. Now he's coming in and asking for late rollover relief, claiming that his medical condition prevented it. Unfortunately, the service said, yeah, but what you ended up doing was using these funds as personal borrowed funds. The ruling makes very clear that the IRS considers using these funds for personal purposes generally is not what Congress intended. More importantly, although the ruling doesn't state so, but you can tell by looking at the dates, it was pretty clear that even if he had been perfectly healthy, you know, a week before the rollover date was to be completed and had no disabled spouse, he simply didn't have the funds available for a number of months until he was able to repay that advance or, you know, come back up with the money. So the IRS determined in this case that, in fact, relief would not be granted. They denied his relief in this case. What this tells us is if you have a taxpayer who misses a date for a reason like this, you need to warn them that we have to get a request for relief in relatively quickly. And more importantly, do not use the money for other purposes. Because the IRS is not going to generally accept a, you know, you should feel sorry for me story, I had all this bad luck. That's not going to work. In this case, they are pretty strict about not liking those funds being borrowed for personal use. Fundamentally, they seem to be okay with that if the funds were available again before the 60-day period is done, and then some other incident prevented you from completing the rollover. But if you're borrowing them for personal funds and you go beyond the 60th day for whatever reason, and those funds are not available, you're simply not going to get relief. That is kind of how the IRS ends up looking at this. Now we actually have in Notice 2015-40, the IRS coming up with a little notice here that borrows from the accounting and auditing side of our profession. Some of you may be aware, although it has been delayed by a year, the Financial Accounting Standards Boards, the International Accounting Standards Boards, have completed, quote-unquote, their revenue recognition project. And the revenue recognition project is going to cause changes in reporting in a whole number of areas. So we're going to have a lot of industries that will be impacted by the revenue recognition standards, not the least of which for many of us will be in the construction area. And the IRS is asking, okay, we're going to have this change in accounting method under FASB's rules. Now, presumably, a whole bunch of taxpayers are going to want to use whatever they're doing for FASB purposes for reporting for tax purposes. In theory, that's not necessarily required because, of course, the IRS could very well say that no, tax rules are different from accounting rules. But recognizing that that may not be the most practical solution, the service is asking taxpayers to give them guidance about how the IRS should react to the FASB change. They want to know what guidance should be appropriate. Particularly, should they allow for changes in accounting method? Remember, under Section 446, a taxpayer must have the IRS permission to change their method of accounting for reporting for income tax purposes. We've had rulings in the past that make clear the mere fact that FASB changes their rules, you can't say, well, my method was to follow FASB. No, if the method FASB uses changes, you need the IRS's permission if you want to use that same method for tax reporting, assuming that method's allowed for tax reporting. Though they ask, basically, how should the rules be adapted? Should the IRS issue some rulings or grant some relief to, potentially, the idea would be probably try to make the IRS reporting rules similar in line with the FASB rules. Should changes that will be allowed, should they have automatic change methods with them? Or should we have to file and request the details? Now, the advantage of the automatic change method, of course, is we don't have to ask permission ahead of time. The negative, of course, is that the IRS is going to write rules in there that are going to be very specific, while if we ask for permission, it's very possible we might get some leeway from the service about how to implement things. So two ways there. And the other question was, for many of these, if we're going to have these changes, should these changes be handled or should the IRS handle such changes as cutoff adjustments or should there be a 41A four-year spread? Cutoff adjustments report based upon basically all the new stuff is going to be recorded under the new method and old stuff under the old tax method. 41A simply restates everything to the new method, going back historically, and then picks up essentially what we call on the accounting side a cumulative method of accounting change and runs that over 4 years. So the IRS is asking for this. They're asking for these comments to come in by middle of September. Presumably the service expects to issue some guidance before the FASB rules take effect. Now, as noted, we got those knocked back, and there's a year delay for private companies as well. But you may want to take a look, and if you do have clients who are going to be affected by the FASB changes, you might want to consider whether or not you want to forward to the IRS some commentary about how they should handle this. Next up, the case of Stowe versus Commissioner, 144 Tax Court Number 6. This particular case deals with a $1 million payment that the taxpayer received and whether it's considered rental income for the taxpayer in the year in question. Now, this particular ruling deals with an interesting part of a part of the code called Internal Revenue Code Section 467 that deals with rental payments and particularly rental payments with uneven rents over them. Now, in this case, the taxpayer had gone out, they'd acquired at the behest of a tenant, they'd acquired a piece of land, developed that land, put up a building on it. Now, under the terms of the lease, it'd be a 10-year lease to the tenant, and the amount of the rent payments would be based on the landlord's investment in the property. The lease agreement provided that the tenant could make a lump sum payment that would effectively reduce the computed amount of investment in the project by the landlord. And because of that, that would reduce their future rents. So they could make an upfront payment. It would reduce rents over the 10-year period, but they'd put the money in upfront. After the building was complete, the tenant basically decided to make a $1 million advance, or basically payment, to the taxpayer. That had been reported on a 1099 miscellaneous, but the taxpayer had decided that it probably shouldn't be properly taxable. Now, the CPA that prepared the return went ahead and showed that $1 million plus $116,000 or the amount, and I forget, that's the $151,000, I should say, that represented rent for the year, put that on as gross income from the rent. But then he backed it off and had a $1 million payment that essentially said it was contribution to construction was listed as an expense. IRS discovers this, finds a return, probably suspicious about $1 million deduction, and decides to disallow it. The taxpayer says, wait, they were simply paying for construction costs, and so it's really like a leasehold improvement. The tax court disagreed. The tax court found that, in fact, the tenant was under no obligation to pay for any improvements. The terms of the lease allowed the tenant to make an advance payment, to make this payment of rent, you know, this payment, not even really advance payment, but make this payment under its option, and that would change the payments down the line. So they said no, they were under no obligation. They simply essentially put the money in. Yes, I know mechanically it goes into this computation, but that's not relevant. Secondly, even if we accepted your idea that, well, they intended it to be a reimbursement of construction costs, the actual terms of the lease indicate, no, it's not. The terms of the lease treat it as a rental payment. So this is rental income. Well, the taxpayer said, okay, if it is rental income, then Section 467 should allow us to spread this over 10 years. Now, Section 467 deals with various rental payments where you make payments over, where you make payments not necessarily ratably over the term of the lease. And you can allocate those rental payments if, in fact, the rental agreement provides how rent is to be allocated per year. Or, in this case, though, the service said and the tax court agreed that the rental payments really didn't say what it was. Merely saying how much you'll pay when does not directly indicate when it'll be over the term. Now, the taxpayer said, well, obviously we intended it to be for the full 10 years. The court said, no, the agreement doesn't say that. And the regulations say if the agreement doesn't say that, then we look at how the payments were, basically what payments were due each year, and you report them when they were due. This option payment needed to be made in the first year to count to reduce rents going forward. Therefore, it was countable in the first year. You were not able to make that work. The taxpayer then went on and said, well, there's a provision in here that allows us to do it over the regular accrual method, so we could do that. So we could essentially treat it as all of these particular rules where we could make it essentially over a, you know, basically proportional rental method. And that method would only apply if it doesn't provide, as I said, adequate interest. And the terms there is kind of interesting. I said for prepaid rent, if you have prepaid rent, you only have prepaid rent if the rules do not provide for adequate interest. And what they say is if there's a prepayment. And the court said, well, we're in trouble here because the prepayment looks at the terms of the lease, and under the regulation, the terms of the lease said this million was due in the first year in order to get full effect. So therefore, the entire $1 million is taxable. The court also makes a key point that 467 largely was enacted to stop abuses, and many of the provisions only apply if the IRS finds that the taxpayer has an abusive arrangement. Court said IRS had made any finding here of that sort. Sorry, guys, you can't use it. Well, no matter what you may think, we're just kind of stuck in this case. You can't make use of this. Rather, the taxpayer ends up being the one that has to make use of that. So, problem, but nevertheless, what we end up doing. Now let's go to Chief Counsel Advice 2015-22-004. This looks at a ruling dealing with whether a payment is considered wages for payroll tax purposes. This took a look at a rule under the state of California's rules that provide under their labor code that if an employee is not paid their final wages timely, there ends up being added to the amount due to the employee an amount that's effectively equal to the wages they would have been paid during the period that the employer is late. It requires no finding a bad fact. You merely have to show the employer failed to make the payment and the employee didn't intentionally kind of hide from the payment. The question before the service was, well, if such a payment is made, does that constitute wages? And there's a concern here because we have had rulings, Quality Stores case, that severance payments are considered wages, so it would be taxable for FICA and FUTA purposes. But in this case, the IRS ruled that, in fact, unlike a severance payment that is earned because of you essentially, because you had received, you'd had services done and you're paying those to compensate them for prior services, this is simply a state-imposed penalty. And the IRS ruled that this is similar to the ruling that you'll find in Revenue Ruling 72-268, where there were liquidated damages provided, where you're paid unpaid minimum wage payments, unpaid overtime under the Fair Labor Standards Act. That while your payment for unpaid, while the payment for unpaid minimum wages and unpaid overtime, those are wages taxable, the additional liquidated damages are not considered payroll taxes because they're damaged. They weren't because of your services. They were because the employer failed to do something. This, they said, is the same way. So anybody who's paying such a penalty does not include those amounts in payroll taxes per Chief Counsel Advice 2015-22004. Next up, Chief Counsel Advice 2015-22005. Continuing on one more down the line. In this particular case, we're going to look at who needs to sign a power of attorney form on behalf of a partnership. This particular LLC, taxes a partnership, had two partners, both of which were corporate. It was a non-TEFRA partnership, so it's not under the unified audit procedures. The partner who was in charge was a subsidiary of a included in a consolidated group. But the parent corporation of the consolidated group was not a partner. Now, of course, IRS exam is coming up and we want to appoint a representative. The question becomes who could sign. Normally, if you have a corporate partner, an officer of the corporate partner would be able to sign the 2848 to appoint a representative. But the IRS ruled in this case because the corporation was a member of a consolidated group and filed a consolidated return for the non-TEFRA partnership, that the non-TEFRA partnership year affected. The subsidiary had essentially given up its rights. The party that has to sign on behalf of the sub is an officer of the parent. So in this case, we need an officer of the parent corporation to sign the 2848 in order to appoint somebody to represent the partnership. The ruling also points out exactly how that party should sign and what language should be used to clarify the nature of how they're signing. But it is an interesting ruling because, as I noted, the officer, it's an officer of a corporation that is not itself a partner in the partnership, but rather owns the partner in the partnership that is signing for this purpose. And what's more important is officers of the subsidiary only do not have standing to sign and authorize someone to represent the partnership in an IRS exam context. So it's a kind of a unique and interesting ruling from that standpoint. Finally this week, we're going to take a look at Revenue Procedure 2015-32. The IRS has made permanent the late filing program for 5500EZ. Now what we have here is if you have an employee benefit plan, like a one-participant plan, we're all aware that one-participant plans, when they file, they don't normally, although they can file 5500, they can file the full-blown 5500 series. Such entities are allowed to file the simplified Form 5500EZ. The 5500EZ that is filed, of course, needs to be filed, and if it's not timely filed, there are some nasty penalties. A late filing of the 5500EZ causes a penalty of $25 for each day the return is late, and ultimately a maximum penalty of $500 per return. Or I should say $15,000, not $515,000. That $15,000 penalty adds up because the problem is, as some of you are aware, that you don't need to file the one-participant plan if your total assets are below $250,000. What often happens is that a small plan gets started by a sole proprietor. Of course, the numbers are below that, so they're told initially, there's no filing because you've got, you know, $40,000 in this account. We don't worry about it. The problem is, of course, over time, that grows above $250,000. They don't notice it. You inherit this client, and now you discover that they have, in fact, not been filing 5500s when required for about the last decade. And, of course, with $25 per day running for that period of time, we're looking at a number of $15,000 penalties that are facing the client if they try to come up to date. Now, they can ask the service for relief under reasonable cause. But that's always kind of iffy because if you don't get it, well, things aren't going to go well. Under this program, the IRS, in essence, you can file. And what you're going to need to do is file the old 5500, but if you elect to come out of this program, you do not have to. You can go for reasonable cause. But if you elect to come out of this program, There is a maximum penalty of $500 for each late filing and an overall cap of $1,500 per plan for the late payment. In order to do this, you go back, you get copies of the prior returns. If it goes back beyond 1990, you can actually use the current year and cross it off. You fill in and file returns with all that information. You submit this to the service, and you pay your penalty. $500 if it's only 1 or 2 years, $500 or $1,000 if it's 3 or more years, $1,500. Now, the catch the IRS points is you cannot ask for relief, for reasonable cause relief, along with this filing. You either decide to pay the $500 or you take your chances with reasonable cause. Of course, the downside with taking your chances with reasonable cause is we're looking at a $15,000 penalty, and we're looking at having to spend all the time to convince the service we had reasonable cause. Therefore, what I can expect is in the future, when you get a late filed, when you have a client who you discover has not been filing the 5500 EZs each year that they should, you're probably going to want to bring them under this program. Now, one quick reminder, why was this program needed? Because some of you who work with plans may remember that we've got the Department of Labor's Delinquent Filer Voluntary Compliance Program. Well, the problem is single participant plans are exempted from Title I of ERISA. They're not covered by that program. That's why there was always kind of a hole there. This is meant to cover that hole. It is run by the IRS. Now, the other caveat the service points out, you have to file 5500 EZs if you do this. You cannot decide to electronically file late the full 5500 SF series form. And they note that they are working on trying to figure out a way to make this work with electronic filing, but for now, if you want to use this relief program, you must file the returns on paper. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of June the 8th, 2015. Want to hope you will hope you'll be back with us next week. We'll talk about developments coming forward. Also, we invite you to go to our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. There we have the write-ups regarding these cases, as well as links to the details here, so you can see the actual rulings or cases that were involved. So if you want to have more information, look there. And, of course, we'll be putting updates there as the week goes on. So we look forward to seeing you next week again when we talk about the new developments in the area of federal taxes.